You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Super curious about how this stuff's going with your kidneys. I mean, like I think when I peripherally heard it, you know, everybody probably thinks the same thing. Oh, you trained at Westside, you know, the anabolic profiles that rotted him out. But I thought it was a much more interesting story than that.
Yeah, I was one of the few that actually followed everything under a doctor's prescription. So when I was drug free, 2003 was my last collegiate nationals. And so I did men's USAPL drug test in nationals in 04. And I went in because I was just lethargic. And I told my mom, she was a nurse practitioner, like, hey, I'm just not feeling real good. And she's like, well, you're training like a fucking asshole. Like, no, you're not recovering. And I said, well, is there any doctors you can send me to see if my hormone levels and all that stuff are straight? And so she sends me to an endocrinologist, and the endocrinologist comes in after the blood work and looks at me with this confused look. And he goes, how much do you lift again? And I said, well, I just squatted 826 as a junior. And he goes, your testosterone level was 300. Mm. So it was low. And so he's like, I don't normally do this, but let's optimize you. He's put me on a half a cc of cypionate. This is at 24 years old, and I switched over to pro, and my blood level stayed somewhere between 850 and 950 throughout my entire career.
Oh, wow.
And that's what was really interesting. And every time I went into my normal doctor, he's like, yeah, your blood pressure is a little high, but it's not high for weighing 300 pounds. It was like 130 over like 88 to 91, you know, not too bad for a powerlifter.
Sure.
And so 2023, I do that Tom Platt squat challenge, and I hit 520 for 24 reps, and nobody had beat 23. And I remember being on the ground for like 20 minutes and just feeling like shit. And that was normal for doing something that was world-class or extraordinary. But what was weird was after a week or so, that flu-ish feeling just never went away. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? So I end up going back to the doctor, and he tells me everything's fine. And then so my good friend Don Saladino, the guy that trains Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman, I'm like, hey, I want to lean out and I want to see how you do it. So I've got some other guys like Stan and stuff and Charles Polkin that have been helping me out. But I wanted to see how he was doing it. And so he takes my blood work and sends it to Dr. Dwayne Jackson. Dwayne Jackson looks at it and gives me a call within an hour. And he's like, you need to go see a kidney specialist. Something's off. And I'm thinking, like, what the fuck? I just got done being at this doctor, tells me I'm fine. Well, come to find out, I'm in like stage 3 kidney disease. Don't even know it because my dumb ass has only been studying testosterone and making sure my hematocrit and hemoglobin are straight.
Sure.
And they weren't out of whack. And so I go look at the EGFR, and then I start pulling up all this information. I'm like, son of a bitch. So I go to this kidney doctor, and the first thing they do is they put me on a really mild blood pressure medicine. But I'm in a panic mode because, you know, I've never had any injuries training. I've eaten fairly clean to weigh 300, but you know what that takes. It takes a lot of fucking calories. But I've strained my ass off, and I've outlasted like 3 generations of powerlifters.
That is true.
So, you know, I was training from the time I did my first bench press meet when I was 13, and my last meet was when I was almost 39. And I was still doing crazy shit after that. And so I go down and go to the kidney specialist, and he's looking at it, and he's not too frightened, but I'm looking at it like this is a fucking death sentence. Well, not more than about 2 months later, the Swiss conference was here in my hometown, which I had just won that, you know, the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Swiss, and Dr. Kahn was speaking. Yeah. And Ed Cohen said, hey, you need to go talk to Dr. Kahn. Maybe they can do some stem cell therapy on your kidneys. And I was like, well, I mean, there's nothing to lose. Might as well try it. And so set up an appointment with him, went down to Cabo, had the stem cells done, and it seemed to stabilize everything, but it didn't improve much. Mm. And so I waited another year, went to the next Swiss, which was last year, and it was back in Toronto. Well, Dr. Kahn has an office in Toronto.
Sure.
So they ran the new MEW Mu stem cells in my arm, and they put like 10,000 or 10 million stem cells in my arm and came back, and my EGFR actually improved. And then all of my other blood markers improved as well. So I'm going back to the kidney doctor and talking to him and asking him if I had damaged it with testosterone. He goes, dude, when we came in, your testosterone level was high normal. It wasn't like 2000 or 3000. It was like 910. And if you look at the scale, that's high average. And so I never really felt better taking more. And so that's what's a weird thing about being at Westside Barbell is people think that we were just, you know, blasting shitloads of drugs. In reality, we were just training a little bit smarter than everybody else. And we knew how to use bands smarter than everybody else and chains. And we had this system of training that really brought about the best, and we competed against each other. So a normal day of strength training at Westside Barbell for max effort legs was every lifter would have won a national competition. And so imagine all of them in one spot competing against each other. But what you don't realize is the level of blood pressure that you're going to. So we did basically like an underwriting study. Dr. Kramer asked me to come into his office at Ohio State and measure my blood pressure under 90% of a world record. So at that time, I had the 865.5 all-time world record and just a belt. And we put 800 on the bar, and he measures my blood pressure, and it's like 390 over 310 when I squat. It's something unbelievable. And he measured Half-Thor Bjorgensen and the Beast and a couple other guys, and their blood pressure's total number was over 600. Doing insane things. So imagine doing that for like 27, 28 years. That's really what the kidney specialist said probably started the process.
Do you think that the gear exasperated it? Like the compression, like the, just like the stress of being strapped in. I mean, I remember when I went out to Westside and Louis had me throw on these briefs and I'd never worn any gear. I remember that first squat down without the box. Like I thought my head was going to explode. I literally stood up so fast, I almost threw the bar off my back. And
I think the equipment definitely can increase cellular pressure, no doubt. I mean, you know, my legs, we'd be sitting to squat 1,000, 1,100, working up to 1,200, and I would have briefs on, my legs would be purple.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think gear might have had something to do with that as well. But, you know, it's one of those things, we caught it just in time before everything really went south. It's not gotten any worse in the last 2 years. So whatever I did sustained it. So that seems to be pretty good. And every time I go in, my numbers get a little bit better. It's just weird. I'm really sensitive to weird medications. I had my left knee swell up just literally out of nowhere, maybe about a year and a half ago. And I took prednisone and it completely rocked my blood sugar for like 6 months. And it took 6 months for my blood sugar to come back down to normal range. Wow. So pre-prednisone, my blood sugar was like 89, which was good. Post, when I went and had my blood work done again, it was like 160. And then it went back down to 90 after I got off prednisone for 6 months. It was super weird. So I noticed that I'm really sensitive with different medications. So I really don't take anything if I have a little bit of pain here and there, I don't take any Advil. I don't take any prednisone. I don't mess with any of that because my body doesn't want to filter it. You know what I mean?
Sure. We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Do you want to build thick sidewalk splitting slabs of muscle? Let me introduce you to Jack Street. Get access to the same tried and true training methods I followed during my 10 years in the NFL, all to walk into training camp at 308 pounds at sub 8% body fat. Punch your ticket to the gain train and join thousands of residents already following Jack Street. Head to powerathletehq.com/Jack Street and claim your 7-day free trial today. Now back to the show.
I think it was on Dave Tate's podcast that you did a while back, you made an interesting point that they thought that like your CK levels and whatnot looked like you'd been almost microdosing rhabdo for 20 plus years. I thought that was an interesting statement because when I had never heard of the term rhabdo. I mean, it wasn't really something until CrossFit kind of popped up. Yeah. So it was funny when CrossFit popped up and people started talking about rhabdo, one of the telltale signs was like, you know, muscle soreness. And the bigger one was like, you know, urine, maybe the color of root beer. And as they were kind of discussing rhabdo, I realized I'd probably given myself rhabdo close to 100 times. I remember after one game going in and having such bad, body pain, trying to piss in the bathroom and literally coming out like,
you know, looked like root beer sludge. And I remember asking people, I'm like, hey, man, like, what does your piss look like? And they're like, looks like black, like your soul. It was kind of our joke. So I think, and then when CrossFit was talking about it, I was like, oh, yeah, I know what that is. I mean, you guys have never done this to yourselves. So I wonder in like professional athlete in circles that this is just part of the equation. And now people are a lot more, you know, intelligent about electrolytes and, you know, salt and whatnot and hydration. So, but I thought that was an interesting statement of like microdosing yourself for 20 plus years with rhabdo. I mean, that's intense.
Well, and my genetics weren't the best. My dad died at 43 of having a weird cancer. He was exposed to Agent Orange. Come to find out, 3-4 weeks ago, my uncle just had a kidney transplant.
Oh.
He's never taken any anabolics. He's never trained, but he's worked his ass off. I mean, he's a guy that gets up at 5 a.m., goes and works in his shop until 7, 8 o'clock at night. So he builds gas tankers for Marathon and Agriculture Systems over on the other side of the state. I actually just went and visited him before his surgery, and he's had kidney issues his whole life. I didn't even know. And it's interesting because, you know, as you get older, your uncles and your aunts start telling you their physical problems when you're 15 years old. They're not explaining that information to you, you know?
Sure.
And so, you know, you play with a sport and you have a certain amount of time or in pressure. And then some people just have different reactions to it. You know what I mean? And so, you know, luckily, like I said, I still train pretty hard. I squatted 705 last week and I only weigh 239. But, you know, if you start having kidney issues, you know, body weight is a huge thing. You need to maintain. You need to maintain low sodium. So it was kind of helping me with my diet anyway, because I wanted to get that down. Blood pressure has been 116 over like 70 for the last year. And everything seems to be clearing out and doing better. So that's good, you know. But, I mean, when you're 19, 20, 30 years old, you're not thinking about those types of things. You're thinking about breaking fucking world records or playing the NFL or, you know, doing something like that. And so now it's just a balance between what can I do and maintain proper blood work. But you find that so many people in our field, especially our age, are just so ignorant to the fact of looking at blood work to maintain and figure out how to eat, how to train, how to recover, how to reduce stress. You know, all of those things are markers that you can keep a keen eye on, especially if you're getting blood work. So I get blood work done for my doctor every 6 months, but I get it done every 3 months just to check.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show.
Yeah, I do every 6 months. The one thing that I thought was really interesting in your story was the fact that you've never had any major injuries. I always felt that injuries were kind of, you know, obviously a curse, but a little bit of a blessing, and that they were an opportunity to kind of reboot. So, I mean, I've dealt with a ton of them where it's almost been like a forced periodization where like, okay, I'm injured now. Now I have to rehab, and kind of lightens the load and you kind of reduce the training. I always wonder if like you'd never been hurt, if like what would have happened. And it's pretty interesting, especially for guys, and I'm sure in the powerlifting world, it's the same way. A lot of the guys that I played with who are actually much younger than me, you know, have had hip and knee replacements and are just replacing joints at will. And, you know, other than like this bone chip I have in the back of my knee, I need to get removed. Like my joints are fine. So I always wonder if maybe some of the injuries acted as a deload in kind of a way.
Yeah. And I think you're right on the money. You know, when people start talking to me about you don't need deloads to train and you don't need downtime, it's fucking garbage. Because anybody that pushes themselves to the limit, you know, coaches like Dan John and other people that are really, really smart with training athletes, you know, when you train advanced athletes, you have to get them to actually shut down versus ramp up. You know, when you want to do crazy shit, you're already ramped up anyway. But I think the biggest thing that I saw, and I don't remember if it was Medvedev's book or Verkhoshansky's book or Zatsiorsky's book, when I was about 19 and going back and forth over to Louis' place, they all talked about having down times of training every month to allow passive tissue to catch up. And when I saw that, I think the one thing that always gave me the advantage to not being injured was that I was never the guy that came into the powerlifting scene and I was the best that I'd ever seen. I had to work for every step that I had to get to. So I was okay with being patient and taking my time and getting accustomed to the loading and being okay with down with deloading. You find in powerlifting in an NFL, you know, which is a cutthroat scenario as well, most people don't have any patience because they feel like they're on a time clock the whole time. So it's give it all you got, blow yourself to pieces. If you make it, you make it. And if you don't, you don't. And I never had that mindset. I wanted to learn how the long-term periodization, building in deloads and allowing soft tissue resiliency in the training actually would advance me, because I didn't start off with, you know, a 500-pound bench or a 800-pound squat. I had to build for multiple years to get there. So I was already patient in my development. Mm-hmm. So seeing having to deload was not a big deal to me because I had 10 and 15-year plans on what I wanted to do.
I've always had worked some form of deload in. I usually like to do it every like maybe month and a half, every like 5-6 weeks. I always feel like it kind of like crests in that way. But I always felt that when I pulled out kind of like proper deload where, you know, like maybe not just getting away from the gym, but maybe just like taking the percentage it up and maybe hitting some little reps, like a little bit of pump stuff, ended up paying such big dividends. Like when I kind of kept like the gas, you know, I always think about keeping the throttle down. I ended up getting hurt and like weird shit would happen. You know, I remember we were all trying to bench 500 pounds and like all of a sudden you like bring the bar down and, you know, you start doing pauses because you're worried about blowing pecs. And I think like when all of a sudden you get into that like kind of cautiousness, it's almost like, you know, you're reaching into that overtraining. And I know you got to overreach, but I don't know where the mentality came that like you shouldn't have a deload.
Yeah, I think it basically comes, the mentality comes from the average person only really strongly works out for 8 to 10 weeks at a time. And then they have these long breaks of don't doing anything. So what you find is a lot of the average people don't have enough consistency to need deloads. That's the argument for some of those coaches, right? Whereas guys like you and me that breathe it, and probably people listening that breathe it, you have to bring down those particular points of training, either in intensity, volume, or duration, in order for the soft tissue to have resiliency. Because, you know, your ligaments, tendons, and your cartilage are usually fed through the lymphatic system. They're not fed through the venous system. So you don't have the blood flow in those areas to create the adaptation of training nearly as quick. Bone is weird. Bone can adapt to training almost as quickly as muscle because it has a cyclic way to build itself up quicker than the passive tissue. But ligaments, tendons, and cartilage definitely take a long time. We covered a lot of that in the book that Human Kinetics has been dragging ass on publishing for the last 2 years. But it's interesting to see how many authors agree soft tissue resiliency and deloading. And that's where I saw it very young. And I wasn't impatient, so that already built in that process.
I can imagine Louie and the Westside Barbell team was not into a deload.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. And, and that's one of the major reasons that him and I had big problems is I was showing Verkashansky what we were doing at the gym, and he asked me, where are your deloads? And I said, well, we compete every Friday in the gym. He's like, well, that's not going to lead anywhere. He's like, how do you guys do in the meets? I said, well, half of us break world records and half of us bomb out. Mm. He goes, well, if you build in the deloading and you have the step down process of recovery, you guys should all do better at meets. So 2007, I start the deloading process without Louis's approval, and Greg Panora ends up following me with it. And Greg Panora goes from around second or third best in the world to breaking the all-time world record. And then I go from like fifth best in the world to second best in the world in the same meet. And even though our numbers were getting better, Louis still liked the competition in the gym. And, you know, it was a hard drive because we tried to, you know, both Greg and I tried to explain to him that, you know, we're competition lifters. We're not gym lifters. And we have to be treating the competitions because that's what people care about. You know, nobody cares. You can squat 1,000 in the gym. If you can't do it in a meet, it doesn't matter.
No, that's universal. We used to run into football players all the time that were incredible practice players, but didn't have that ability to reach that second gear or that next gear, or really just be able to push it.
Absolutely.
I work with, you know, I train in jiu-jitsu and I train some of the world's best guys. And one of the things I was hopefully instill upon them is like the training in here has got to be pretty intense. But when you step out on the mat and the lights hit you and you're wearing all the fancy stuff, like it has to go up. Like you can't be like your best roles can't be in the gym. Your best training can't be in the gym. Like your best performance can't be in practice. And I'm sure you've seen a ton of guys that were killing it in practice and in the gym, but then they go in the meet and they can never convert.
The stuff that I've seen at when I was at Westside Barbell or even training with Chuck afterwards were things that I'll probably never in my human life see again, but they were more impressive than the things we saw in the meets. So like, I'm not even shitting you that Chuck Vogelpohl had the potential to squat 1300 at 242 body weight. And I had seen him do similar amounts of tonnage in the gym, but he'd go to the meet and he'd bomb out because he couldn't let go of doing everything heavy so close to contest. And then I would actually back down 14 days prior. I would talk to Verkashansky about how to do this and how to do that. I'd go to the meet and get 20, 40, 50, sometimes 80 pounds better every meet I go to. And with him, it was a crapshoot. He'd either break a world record or he would bomb out. And a lot of that was just the timing of his strength, you know. And I find that the lighter that you are, the more tuned in it has to be. The older you are, the more tuned in it has to be. Or the more explosive you are, the more tuned in it has to be, because strength in certain percentages is not relative with advanced lifters versus intermediate lifters, because an advanced lifter knows how to turn on high threshold motor units. That's not the problem. The problem is can you conserve it at the right time, versus intermediates have not really seen their peak, you know, ability, because they still can't turn on those high advanced motor units to hit those big numbers yet. So when they max, it's not really a max, but like when Chuck maxed or I maxed or, you know, Vlad maxed, it was a max. It was 100% because the tissue couldn't go any farther. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Did you guys do anything outside the gym, or do you still do anything presently outside the gym, like any type of recovery modalities? Like what kind of things did you start incorporating? Like, you know, obviously deloading in the training, but what was outside the space?
Yeah. A lot of that was, you know, a lot of it was just honestly is just recovering and coming down from that sympathetic nervous system. You know, I remember going home and just feeling like I got hit by a train. And I remember Louie talking a lot in different articles about, you know, restoration workouts and this and that. But once you got to an ultra elite level, you just didn't have the energy for any of that. I remember like I would try to go on small walks just to loosen things up, or just, you know, I could lay on the ground and do like band stretching, but the training was so extreme that we just didn't have the energy to be able to do that. I mean, I think all that sounds amazing until you put four times body weight on your back and then you're like, go tell me you want to go do a restoration workout. Now, as I got older and I got in better shape, I did more and more and more. So like now I'll walk 2.5-3 hours a week, not at one time, but split up throughout the week. And I'll do small little mini workouts here and there. But most of that's just to stay healthy. But I think that if you're in an intermediate level, that mini workouts can be conducive to performance gains. But as you get more and more advanced, it's just more recovery. And I remember reading that with Vasily Alexeyev talking about once he got up to like world record 50, it was like all that was already tuned in. Now it was just optimizing his energy level to put it right where he needed it, you know, right when he had the opportunity to do it at a world meet or an Olympic meet. And so it's interesting, you know, you work really, really hard to get to an advanced level, and then you have to get smart enough to optimize your training. And that's different for everybody, right? Like, you know, some people probably could use mini workouts and get better at it, and some people are just going to need more sleep. And I think the hard part is getting your nervous system to come back down into recovery mode, so you're actually recovering when you're not working out, because most people stay too ramped up all the time, and then they're just frying themselves, you know, neurologically. And I was always really good. I think that was my biggest superpower, was when I got out of the gym, I was really good at detuning and just recovering. And I think a lot of people had a lot of problems with that, especially at Westside Barbell for sure.
Yeah. No, the one of the ones that struck me is when I went out there to visit Louis, he had, you know, sent me the books and he had kind of talked to me about it. And then when I went out there, I didn't see anybody doing any of these extra mini workouts. I didn't see any of the recovery stuff. I didn't see any of his GPP work and the conditioning. Like he was the only one that was doing it. And I kind of imagined that these guys were coming in training and coming back in this. And like, I was like, this is different than what is put out to the world. So I always got a kick out of that.
Well, I remember the first time I remember the first time somebody calling him on his bullshit was Chuck and I were sitting and eating somewhere, and Louis had just wrote an article on Mike Ruggiero. Yeah, it was probably before your time, but Mike Ruggiero was one of our super heavyweight guys. It was a fucking monster. He had the biggest shoulders I've ever seen in my life, but he also had a very distended stomach because he was about 360 pounds. He was one of Westside's first, I'd say 1,100 or maybe higher, over 1,000-pound squatters back in the mid-late 90s. And he used to write articles about Mike Ruggiero doing reverse hypers. Mike Ruggiero's midsection was so big he couldn't fit on a reverse hyper. He never even used it. And that's when I saw the article and then asked Mike Ruggiero, hey, how many reverse hypers are you doing a week? He's like, I can't even fit on that fucking machine. And I'm like, oh, my God. But not to bust his balls too bad, because he taught me so much. And I would have never had the access to the books. I would have never had the access to the environment to break world records. That was the real power for him, you know. But I think the hard part was, is he really couldn't compete anymore. And so he wanted it to be a competition in the gym. That's what he wanted to feed on. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways it diluted a lot of people's numbers more than it helped once they got to a certain point. I remember talking with a guy named John Stafford. And John Stafford was one of the first guys to total over 2,400 at Westside Barbell. And I remember us talking about it extensively, like, you know, you got to know when to just shut it down. And it's going to piss Louis off. He's not going to like it, but you're going to have to learn how to recover. And so I learned that a little bit from Stafford initially, but it was a weird situation, you know, because if you weren't one of the top guys and you backed off too much and you still didn't perform in contests, yeah, you weren't in that gym very long, because Louis didn't want that. He wanted that, you know, that killer instinct mentality. And so you had to do it real smart. And sometimes I was smart at doing it and other times I was not. So, a lot of times it created friction, and other times if I did real well to meet, oh, Matt knows what he's doing, you know, because I was one of the only ones in there that was highly educated. I had the master's degree at the time. And so Louis kind of fed on that when it worked towards his advantage, but he would turn it around and be like, you think too much. You just need to fucking train. You know what I mean? So I don't know.
I always find when people pass away, all the edges get knocked off and people tend to remember. Like, I'm sure you've been to funerals where all of a sudden people get up there and they're talking about what amazing person this was. And you're sitting there being like, I knew this motherfucker. This isn't at all how this guy should be remembered. So I remember years ago, my brother and I, we were actually at a funeral, and they got up and the guy was a fucking dickhead. And everybody was talking about what a great he was. My brother's like, when I pass away, if you're at my funeral or I'll be at yours, I just want you to call it straight. Like, I don't want this fucking bullshit. And like, Louis was a tortured soul in a lot of ways and very complex character. But his impact is undeniable. And there's no shame in being like, you know, his impact was incredible. He was also a fucking crazy person.
Yeah. And he was fucking crazy. And again, I think you notice he didn't have a funeral. He didn't even have a way to be able to even do that. You know, and it was interesting because when we did that Westside versus the World documentary, he's the one that sent that film crew down to my gym. And I'm thinking, how do I approach this? Like, we were still in bad. We didn't talk a whole lot. We would fist bump if I saw him out at a restaurant. Like, I'd see him at Texas Roadhouse or Longhorn every once in a while.
He did love Texas Roadhouse.
We'd be like, hey, what's going on? And fist bump. But we talked maybe for a couple seconds, but it was a bad situation for a long time. And when he sent that film crew down to do that Westside versus the World documentary, which you can watch free on YouTube, it kind of like, what the fuck am I supposed to say about this guy? And I thought that they painted the right picture. I think they saw that we had the animosity, but we both respected each other. I think that's the way it felt when I saw it, you know, which I thought was awesome. And it was exactly true. I mean, it's one of the few documentaries that you can watch and none of it was fluffed out. They didn't paint him to be like you're saying at a funeral, like, oh, this guy was amazing and he was perfect. It painted him exactly the way he was. Right. Which was fucking crazy.
No, I mean, it's, oddly enough, he called me on the phone and asked if I would be interviewed for that Westside versus the World, because when I was in college, my roommate had like a VHS tape for, you know, like the West Side bench stuff.
Yeah,
and at the end, there was a phone number, you know, call. And so we ended up dialing up the number And, you know, Doris picked up, hey, this is, you know, Westside Barbell. Is Louie there? Lou, you know, and he came and I was like, hey, I'm playing college football. I'm going to try to bench 500. What do I do? And he like literally was like, get out a pen and paper and started just spouting things off. He was like, it's got to be, you know, dumbbells and this. And he went through everything. I want you to do that. I mean, wrote this program. I ended up benching 500.
Yeah.
And then when I met him many years later, I recounted the story. And like, he didn't remember, but then he said he didn't remember. And it was kind of awkward because I was like, man, I wonder if this guy forgot and I don't want to make him feel bad. But then he's like, you know, so it was kind of this like tense moment. Yeah. And then he's like, okay, I remember. I'm like, all right, dude, because I'm pretty sure I didn't hallucinate that. So, yeah. But yeah, so he ends up sending them down to me and, you know, was a very interesting kind of deal. And I'm glad I thought the documentary was excellent. And I thought it painted it in the light that it should have been painted. And yeah, I always worry with a lot of this stuff. They want to like kind of knock the edges off of everything. And it's like, dude, like the edginess was what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was all there. It all showed everything that I think it should have been shown, you know, and interesting fast forward a couple of years later, he sends me the Iron Samurai book and he signs it and, you know, his writing is terrible because he barely graduated high school. And and I open it and I read it and he says he's proud of me. And I'm like, this is fucked up. I knew something was wrong. Yeah. And so I call him and I hadn't called him in like 12, 14 years. I call him. I'm like, maybe he's ready to like talk again, you know? And I come to find out that the fire department that I train ran on him when he died. And I knew he died probably before anybody else because I saw the medics.
Yeah.
They messaged me, hey, your old coach passed away. And he had done that probably a week before he died. And I tried to get a hold of him because I wanted to, you know, apologize to him and tell him I was sorry and tell him about all the things I learned from him. And yeah, I didn't get that chance. But my point being is Louie didn't care. Like he knew that that point in time of his life and my life, we had something special. He liked it. He didn't remember he wrote that workout for you, but it's still the effort was there at that time. And I think Louie just kind of, you know, he was in his life for a little while and then you weren't, and it just wasn't a big deal to him. You know what I mean? It was just kind of how he lived.
Yeah. When he was at the end, he was pretty sick. Like, so he, you know, he had asked me to be in that West Side versus the World deal. And I said to him, hey, you know, like, I'm happy to do this for you. You know, you've given so much, but like at some point, like, I'd love to be able to get you on the podcast. And, he was always like, every time I'd hit him up, he's like, ah, you know, and after he got smoked in that, I think it was Joe Rogan. And then it was Vice went out there and kind of did that gotcha on him. He was real apprehensive about doing other people's podcasts. So yeah. I kind of check in. And then I got a phone call from, is it Tom?
Yeah, Tom.
Yeah. And he said, hey, you know, like Louie's close. Like if you're ever going to do this, like we got to do it soon. So I was like, well, tell me when. And I flew out and we ended up doing the podcast with him, which was the last one he did. And I remember him coming in and like the swelling in his legs and he was carrying this thing because, you know, his heart was basically broken. And he, you know, he couldn't survive the anesthetic. So they had him on this machine. And I remember him kind of talking about the regrets and like, kind of like West Side was here and how it kind of followed. And I kind of got this funny feeling. I'm like, you know, the metaphor for what this guy has, you know, this bag, almost this like thing he was carrying around that was keeping his heart running. But it was actually a broken heart that he was dying of. And it was broken heart that he had felt that West Side had fallen out of this, like, you know, Mount Rushmore pinnacle where he was having to pay people to come and there weren't people fist fighting to get in the door. And that original West Side, what it was made, you know, like as he envisioned it was no longer the case. And he made a kind of an interesting point where he was like, I think after the cameras turned on, he's like, well, my time here is almost done. And he was like, almost like Yoda, you know, disappearing into disappearing into the robe. And, you know, I think it was like, you know, 7-10 days later, you know, we got the phone call that he had passed away. And I was like, man, that old man died of a broken heart.
From what I think, from what I know is his kidneys got cooked at the end and his EGFR was low and he didn't want to go on dialysis. Yeah. And that changed his potassium level and it cooked his heart.
So
there's a lot of people that'll have kidney issues. Mild kidney issues, they get heart attacks and they don't realize that their initial problem was the kidney because the kidneys regulate your potassium. And so once your potassium goes up to a certain level, your heart explodes pretty much.
So where do you think, I mean, is it the drugs? Is it the training? Is it the overtraining, the gear? I mean, or is it just the lifestyle? Is it being big?
It's a mixture. I mean, we see people that have never taken any anabolics in dialysis all the time. So I don't know that it's necessarily the drugs. What I think it is I think it's a mixture. It's like anything else. It's a lot genetics, it's environment, and it's medications, right? Like anything your body has to take and filter, i.e. alcohol, i.e. pain medicine, i.e. poor selections in food, your kidneys have to work harder to do that. And when they do, your organ, your kidneys especially, don't really have an ability to regenerate, you know, without external help. And even then, like I said, I think the stem cells are more of a stop the process from getting worse versus improvement. You know, it's a multifactorial thing. And I think Louis lived his life like he wasn't going to live past 60. You know, Chuck did the same thing. I did the same thing. You know what I mean? And that was the price, you know, the price to be a fucking badass and be a super strong lifter is all that stuff has to go out the window for that period of time. And then you hopefully, not everybody, you know, Matt Dimmel passed away and a couple other guys passed away, but you get past that point in your life where maybe training is still important to you, but it's not everything to you. And you look back and you were like, I don't know if that was really worth it. It was worth it at the time because you're chasing, you want to be the best in the world, not realizing that, you know, maybe only a couple thousand people really care. And at the end of the day, you know, what was those goals for? I think I had a lot of fun and I learned a lot doing everything, but I don't know that I would tell other people to have the same sacrifices that I had. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There was a very large price to pay for all those advancements and being a 1,000-pound squatter for almost 20 years and doing all that stuff. And it's awesome. But like, how many people really care now? You know, I'm more known as a coach and work with tactical athletes and help like the San Diego Padres and the Cleveland Cavaliers. And I don't know that breaking all-time world records would have got me any farther. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's hard because everybody that wants to come up and be that, they think everything is going to change. And reality, I don't know that it does. I think what changes is how can you help other people achieve their goals or whatever is important to them at that time. And that's why I was happy to achieve the goals that I did, but I did it as smart as I could in order to learn the lessons taught through that level. So if you came to me in your prime and like, hey, Matt, I want to be able to bench 500. I've fucking done that. And not only have I done it, I've done it 115 pounds heavier. So I know what it's like to get to 500 and I know what it's like to get past that or be stuck at 450 or 460. How do you reach the 500 range? Because sometimes it's not as simple as just training harder or, you know, fixing a certain muscle group. Sometimes it's technical. Sometimes it's a bar speed thing. Like I'd never learned any of that if it wasn't for Louis. Sometimes it's your training too specific for the exact goal, right? Like you might need to be using different bars or different resistance types, or your body's already accustomed to this environment. You need to change this and that. Those are the things you learn when you push your own limits. And that's why I think it's really difficult right now in the fitness industry is everybody's a fucking expert and they haven't done shit, right? And now you have all this CGI where somebody can just in 15 minutes run through a filter and act like they look like they work out. I remember, have you seen Brent Contreras just post on that like the last couple of days?
No.
Average. He changes the lighting. He gets a little pump. He sucks his stomach in and he does like some AI airbrushing, just very mild. And it's like, he looks like he lost 15% in 15 minutes. And you're just like, what the fuck is going on? Whereas back in the day, like me and you saw Bo Jackson and you were like, oh shit, this guy is jacked. Yeah. Or you saw Michael Jordan when he started lifting weights, or they didn't have that shit back then. So I don't know. I just think we get so sucked into what's fake and what's real that people just don't have any conception of anything anymore.
Well, the majority of what we're reading on the internet is produced by AI. I mean, that's something that I have taken kind of like a personal kind of thorn against, in that, you know, all the content that we've created and whatnot was all written, you know, and even to the point where, you know, you put the stuff in AI for some filters or even some, you know, like proofreading type stuff. And it's just like, oh, so, I mean, the majority of what people are creating is coming off through some form of AI. Yeah. The information, the pictures, everything's getting kind of put together with this artificial intelligence. I think what's going to eventually happen is people are going to lose faith in the internet. They're going to lose faith in all of this. And at that point, I don't really know. I mean, it's almost going to be like a fax or a newsletter that maybe gets mailed to your house, because like no longer can you discern between what is truth, what is not, what is faction, what is fiction, what's being, you know, artificially created. My daughter's a 13, and my daughter was like, you know, they just got Instagram, but I was like, you guys can't post anything. You can use it to kind of like follow, like my daughter plays basketball. So she wants to follow North Carolina basketball and football. And she's kind of totally into this like NIL deal. But so she shows me an account and she's like, Dad, this entire account of this girl is all AI. And she has like 150,000 followers. And literally we're going through the pictures, and this girl is like an 11 out of 10, like smoke show. At all these, I mean, she's at, you know, Coachella, she's here, I mean, everywhere. And she's like, this is AI. And so, of course, we click through and it's like, oh, you know, I'm trying to explain that, like, what this is. But it's, you know, for people that didn't grow up with this, like, you would look at that and be like, oh, it just looks airbrushed. No, it's legitimately doesn't exist. So I think what'll end up happening, and I think this is what we're seeing with a whole lot of people that are espousing a bunch of information that's obviously not their own, at some point, I think people will go back to those that have actually done this, just out of a desire for authenticity. I mean,
yeah, that's the hope. I mean, that's the hope. That's why we try to get guys on the apps and come on to online coaching, you know, and do stuff like that. That's actually real. You know, it's just unbelievable the shit you see, and then how wrong it really is. And this is interesting because, especially in strength training, what made me really want to dive into the book with Human Kinetics was the fact that most of the information that I learned and that's in those books behind me and others is that you don't see that on the internet. Like, that kind of shit is not on the real shit's not on the internet.
No.
You know,
I mean, I talk about compensatory acceleration almost every chance I have, and people like think that it's magic. And I was like, dude, the old power lifter that trained me, George Zangas, who's the guy that invented the super suits and the wraps, marathon nutrition. Yeah. That was, that's where I got my start at 14 years old. He learned probably from
Fred Hatfield.
Well, yeah. And he talked about, cause he sponsored Fred, for his 1,000 squat and gave him wraps and the whole thing. And then it was funny, cause when I talked to Fred, Fred was still pissed at him that he said he screwed up money. Right. But he talked about, you know, his good friend, Fred Hatfield, and compensatory acceleration. And a lot of these things that were these, so impactful in not only my own training, but going on and playing professional football. And people talk about them and as if they've never heard these things. And I'm like, dude, as mechanical advantage increases, so does bar speed. Like,
I was very fortunate enough to run into Fred Hatfield at an NSCA conference, maybe a year or two before he died. And I remember him being way shorter in person than I thought he was. He was only maybe like 5'4".
I was going to say 5'4" if he was lucky.
Yeah. And I said, and he came up to me and I had just got done speaking, and I was speaking on max effort method. And I talked about how important it was, but how important the dynamic effort method was in reality, and how you could turn on pretty much the same amount of motor units as you can with max effort work. And that's the purpose of it. And he came up to me after the talk and he's like, I am so proud that you, the next generation, is keeping speed work alive, because the bodybuilding scene has no idea about it. The most powerlifters don't even fucking use it anymore because a lot of them never studied all the old shit from Louis. You know, Fred Hatfield's been gone for so long and hit his numbers so long ago that his stuff is like behind, like, you know, an iron gate. And it's not that you can't find it. You don't see it a lot.
Sure.
And it's interesting how when you have an audience that's really into working out and you show them the stuff that's not on the internet and in those books, and they're just like blown away. And I'm like, if you were trying to get super strong yourself, you'd already figured this out. You know, so I get like frustrated because I'm like, so what you're telling me is when you ask me this question is you've never gotten to a strength point, say a 300-pound bench, where your goal was to get to 350 and you didn't learn that you had to get faster to get stronger. See, to me, you learn those things as you step through. And that's why I like the Russian manuals, because at 18, 19, when Louis first handed them to me, I couldn't understand them, because I wasn't living that life. And then as you live, the percentages and the durations and the deloads and all the shit there, you start reading it, it's almost written in like Braille. Like, you read it and you're like, if you live it, you're like, I know exactly what they're saying, because even though it's broken and the English doesn't transfer over real well to the Russian, you look at it and you've lived it, you understand what they're saying, you know? And again, like I open up those books every time I open up those books again, I pick up something new. And most of the time it has to do with bar velocity. Right. And that's, again, it's just, it's hard to tell people when they see strength, we've tied in strength to muscle mass, but we haven't tied in strength to rate of force.
Well, I feel like at least for what the algorithm is pushing me, which I always have to preface everything with that, because if you click on your social media, the information they're feeding you is what you think the whole world is getting. And it's basically curated for you. But for some reason, I'm getting a lot of hypertrophy stuff lately. And I'm getting a lot of these like science-based lifters and these guys that look like they've never lifted weights. talking about like all this research and joint angles and this and this. And I was like, how did this get into my Instagram feed? Cause this isn't really what I'm interested in. I'm interested in athletes that are able, like big, strong athletes that are able to move through space, that are athletic, that are able to do things and like using like I never viewed the weight room as like the proving ground for me, you know? I figured this out pretty quick. I mean, that year that I went to bench 500, I felt that I got slower. And I ended up pushing my bench and ended up doing, I think it was 535 for a triple was my best. But I don't feel that like my punch increased, my hand speed didn't increase. So when I started kind of, you know, taking it back and actually doing more speed work instead of more max effort stuff, I feel like my hand speed increased and I ended up increasing my punch power. So
absolutely. Yeah. You're absolutely right. And that's the thing is like people don't understand, like there's a certain point where the strength won't transfer over to anything that's highly explosive.
Yeah.
But for most people, getting stronger will get you more explosive to a point.
Right up until where it doesn't.
Yeah. But back to your original point is if you really do statistics and look, and I've done this a couple of times, not any time recently, because I just write what I want to write and people don't like it. Fuck it. I don't care. But like 75% of the people that walk into the gym that go into it, actually have the balls going to the fitness facility, which is only 4% of the population, are all about aesthetics. Which actually creates a huge problem, because what do you train when you have aesthetics in mind? You train what you see in the mirror. And the real performance gain is everything you can't see in the mirror. And nobody wants to train that, right? Like you ever walked into a normal gym and all the, if they have it, all the equipment that develops the lower back or the mid back or the hamstrings are usually pretty empty, and everything training all the muscles in the front is full and you're waiting 15 minutes to do a pec deck or a preacher bicep curl or something for the front delts. Cause that's what they envision, what they see, because they don't have the performance mindset of, well, shit, if I overtrain this and undertrain this, now I got a shoulder impingement and it doesn't even matter what my goals are. I'm fucked because my shoulders are fucked.
Sure.
But nobody has any mindset of that.
That's why I am a huge Brett Contreras fan. I mean, the fact that he convinced an entire generation of girls to have like good glutes and big butts and big hamstrings. I've said this on the podcast. I'm like, this guy has done more for this country and more for this world than like, you know, anybody. I mean, he really is doing God's work. And when I click on his stuff, I'm like, every one of these girls has a great, literally posterior chain. I'll say it has a great ass. And I'm like, dude, this stuff is, I mean, it's pretty good. I mean, but if you look at every speed, every sprinter, anybody, I've never met anybody that was fast that didn't have big hamstrings, big glutes, and big adductors.
Yeah, and exactly right. And you know, the thing of it is, but most of those girls are not there because it's protecting their spine or making them squat more. They're there because of the aesthetics.
Yeah.
Because now we view a nice ass as, oh, that's attractive. But if you say, hey, you got to build up your glutes, to a normal person, you got to build up your glutes to run faster. They're like, fuck you. I don't need to run. You know, or my lower back hurts. Maybe it's because your glutes don't work.
Yeah.
Well, what do I have to do for that? You know, that's too much work. You know what I mean? So point being is like 4% of the population trains, and of those 4%, 75% of them go in for an aesthetic mindset versus a structural awareness mindset or a performance mindset. So it's a very small population that actually, I find that if you always train performance first, you always have a better base and then aesthetics last. I mean, you look at, you know, Dorian Yates and Ronnie Coleman come to mind. They were ex-powerlifters before they became bodybuilders. So their background was a little bit more in the compound movements. They became some of the best bodybuilders in the world because some of those muscle groups that they had at their time, the other bodybuilders didn't have because they trained bodybuilding style. right? Yeah. That's just off the top of my head, but.
And Yates was another proponent of deloads. And like how much, like what was the minimal effective dose, maximal effective dose? Like if you're really training with true intensity, you know, like how many training sessions can you get a week? And, you know, the idea of like, hey, you're going to train 6 days a week. And he's like, dude, this is, and like in the early days when we were training, like that's what we saw, these guys are training 6 days a week. I guess we got to train, not realizing that all those injuries came from the fact that these dudes are taking a ton of drugs and almost like the drugs are band-aiding shitty training. And like it wasn't until actually we watched Blood and Guts on the VHS. My roommate had it. He was a big power lifter in high school and had all this stuff. And I remember watching Blood and Guts and being like, oh, I get it now. That was probably one of the more impactful things I ever saw in my training, where it's like, oh, if it's you know, because they would set us sets and reps in college, right? Like you're gonna do a, you know, set of 10, let's say, with lat pull downs. I didn't realize that a set of 10 means I can't get 11. Until I watched Blood and Guts, I figured like, oh, just put a weight on. We'll do it 10 times. We'll go to the next thing.
Whatever.
And then I watched Blood and Guts and I was like, oh shit, he can't get 11.
Real failure.
Yeah. And then I realized, I was like, oh, those reps are at the top end of this. Like I'd much rather have you, if you're going for 10, I'd rather you get 9 and fail on 10 than be able to get 15 reps.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's all about the intent of the actual set more so than the rep scheme or anything like that. You know, in that new book by, hold on, I have to turn around and look. I can't remember his name. Brian Schoenfield says that, you know, that repetition for hypertrophy ranges can anywhere between 4 and 25 or plus. It's about the intent of the set, not necessarily the set of 8 or 10 or 12 work for the, let's just say, hypertrophy goal. It's the intent in which that 8, 10, 12 is done, right? And so that's why I find the training cycles that I do, when I had developed the winning warmups, was I knew as a powerlifter, I was ignoring sets of 20, 25 reps. So it was a way for me to attack a different rep scheme in some cases that I wasn't using in my normal training. And it elicited some amazing results based on the fact that I was having a larger spectrum of repetition ranges. So my warmups were 25s, 20, my main lifts were 5 or under, and my accessories were pure failure, somewhere between 8 and 15. Where's the weak link? Nowhere, right? So you're training all of those repetition ranges in the workout. Therefore, you're improving your full spectrum of repetition ranges that can affect the muscle tissue.
What was the frequency of training per week? I mean, what did
4.
You break it?
I never took more than 4. Yeah, and, you know, and I learned that from training years and years and years. I, same as you, started off all. You got to train 6 days a week. You got to split these body parts. You got to do this, you got to do that. And then I started realizing that if I only needed muscle stimulus every 72 hours by Zatsigorsky, that set that I only needed to train the muscle groups twice a week, right? Once every, you know, or twice every 144 hours. And so I did that for upper and lower. And I started that process around 20 years old, still do it today. And so I find that if you're really training optimally, you probably can't train more than 4 days a week. If you're really doing like, and Dorian Yates agreed with it with bodybuilding, Louie agreed with it with powerlifting, I've agreed with it with tactical, special operations, basic firemen and clients that I have at the gym. They don't get any better for more than that. And that's only if everything's fucking optimal. That's if they're sleeping good and eating good and recovering good and keeping stress low. You have one of those out, you might only be able to recover from 2 or 3 times a week. So again, I use this saying all the time, it's not what you can do, it's what you can recover from. And most people don't look at their training as, what can I recover from? They just think that, you know, there's a set scheme that they have to achieve in order to get better. But if you can't recover from it, it's not any good.
And then how are you interpreting recovery? Is it through like rate of perceived effort, strength? I mean, if you're not getting stronger each week, then obviously you got to, you know, fucking make a U-turn or start kind of, you know, changing some things.
Yeah. I mean, consistency is key. I mean, you know, again, looking at everything as a performance base, like did I get stronger? There's a lot of other avenues of performance enhancement. Did my technique get better? Because now my muscle weaknesses and strengths might be a little more balanced. Did my bar speed get better? So a lot of times I can tell if my max effort's too hard on my dynamic day, if my bar speed slows below 0.7 meters per second. On max days, usually I'll decide what RPE range I'm going to get by my blood pressure in the morning. So if my blood pressure is really good in the morning, I know that I can go heavy as fuck. But if it's still a little wacko, I know the training in that week has been a little bit too difficult. I back down 1 or 1.5 RPE. So instead of doing, say, a 9.5, 10 RPE, I go back down to a maybe an 8, 8.5. I fully recover. And the next week I can go at it hard as shit again. Yeah. So I've been, because I've balanced my blood pressure for so long, I know when I'm overtrained by my blood pressure.
Yeah, but you also know what an RPE is. That's another thing I run into. Sure. Like the only people that understand that are actually people that have pushed past 10 and are more advanced lifters. So when I have people that reach out that are like, hey, you know, like what's the RPE on this? I'm like, what's your perceived? For most people, like, I don't know if they've ever pushed past that.
Yeah.
So then like, I mean, you say, and I understand it, but like when I hear the majority of the world use it, I'm like, I think this is a waste.
Great point. And RPE and percentages, in my opinion, can be flip-flopped. What I like about RPE is it's adjustable. When you base stuff off percentages, it's locked into a number that you may or may not have that day. We know through heavy training that your ability to strain at maximum is varied around 10%. I have the somewhere back there, the references on that, but if you have a 10% variation daily, then how can you follow percentages in training? That's what Mevdiev figured out with the Dynamo Club.
Yeah.
But I find that percentages are much easier for people to calculate. So I find that from year one to year maybe 4 or 5, following percentages is probably better because you don't know how to strain yet anyway. Yeah. After that point, you can probably convert over to an RPE scale, or you have an advanced coach that can see what your RPE is. And then again, that comes with cost, money, et cetera. But a lot of people that are really good coaches can see through video or hands-on at a gym what a real RPE is. We got people on the Patreon channel that are flying in this weekend to actually max at the gym with the clients that are there all the time so we can get a real 1RM, right? Because now I can, they know what a 10 RPE is when they fucking die. You know what I mean? That's when the 10 RPE is. So now when they see a 9, they know the set before that was 9.
Sure.
They know when that feels to stop. And that's really the reason why they're coming in to learn that.
Would you say too, for most people, they undershoot their ability? Like because I've seen this, like, you know, we used to constantly do this with people who have them come in, squat a heavy 5 reps or whatnot, end up kind of cutting it back to 80% and kind of do some of the Hatfield testing where they're doing muscle fibers and at 80%, how many they're getting. And like, I'd watch people, you know, fail at reps that I know they could get, you know? And so I always wonder like if, like how long it takes somebody to kind of like crest over where they actually understand strain and being able to push through by what they think is possible.
Well, that's where that 10% daily variation comes in, right? That's what makes people either champions or not. And say in powerlifting, for example, is can you be the strongest you possibly can be on meet day, right? Or testing day if you're not a competitor. And that is very, very complex science for a lot of people. But what I find is that for most people that are long-term lifters that want to be really good, is that you almost are better off being a little undershot than overshot. I'll give you a prime example. When I benched 611 after squatting the all-time world record, which was one of the highest subtotals in history at that time, when I did that, I based my percentage-based training the last 3 weeks on 585, not 615. And the reason was for recovery. I knew that I had to recover from that number. And so if I dropped it down, say 5 or 10%, I had a better chance of recovering and actually being strong when it mattered. So I think that you're almost better, and I hate to say this, but you're almost better undershooting than you are overshooting. Because usually overshooting, you're either testing a soft passive tissue that's not ready, or you're testing a technical capacity that's probably going to fall apart. So I think that technical max, training force maximums is what the Russians would call, is probably your best bet in 99% of training. Competition force maximums are hard to calculate, and they're also hard to super compensate into prime position for even the average person and sometimes even advanced people. So training force maximums usually are limited by the technical capacity of the person versus the actual straining mechanism, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I kind of want to go back a little bit. So obviously you did the stem cells with the deal down at Cabo. And then when you went to Canada, you did the Muse cells. Did you notice anything different, like other than, you know, the kidney, like, did you notice any other physical kind of improvements?
Well, my body's always felt pretty good, you know, so I don't really have a lot of joint pain. I mean, every once in a while I'll get something swell up and get pissed off for no reason. Prime example, last Saturday, I squat 705, feel pretty good. The next day I'm kind of tired. 3 days later, I wake up out of bed and my right ankle is pissed off for no reason for like 30 hours and then it goes away. I'm like, what the fuck is going on, right? But for me, my energy level came back. I felt like maybe I knocked a couple years of aging off. I just felt a little bit more, a little younger. I just felt a little younger. But on the blood work, I didn't notice it attacked a lot of my kidney function. But what it did do is seemed to drastically change blood pressure. It dropped another like 3-4 points consistently over the next 2-3 months. And I also noticed that I just moved around better. But I didn't notice that it actually fixed the organ problem. Now, I think all kinds of different people are going to have different reactions to it based on their genetics and how they respond to those stem cells. But the Muse stem cell, from what I know, it's a coating that goes around the stem cell that keeps your natural immune system from fighting the stem cell away and gives it more time to attach to the damaged or tissues or whatever it may be. But from my personal experience, I've seen better results from hearing other people get it with muscular and soft tissue injuries and not necessarily organ fixes. Mm-hmm. So if you have a knee problem or an ankle problem or a shoulder problem, I've seen a lot of people get a lot of results from stem cells, but organ recovery, I'm not so sure. I've seen a ton of it. I've seen it stop it getting worse, but not necessarily improve. That's just my own.
Yeah.
My own.
So my son's a type 1 diabetic and so we've been kind of managing that. And, one of the things, which is pretty interesting is I think it's in South Korea and China and Japan, they're basically using Muse stem cells and pluripotent stem cells to fix and repopulate the pancreas and fix the beta cells. Hmm. So, I've been talking to a deal about this for years cause he has early supporters has a child that has type 1. So we've talked a lot about it. And it was funny. He recently just kind of like anything pops up, we go back and forth. And he actually reached out and was like, hey, you should come down to Cabo and try these Muse cells. So we were kind of going back and forth. And I just did some ancillary research. But it was as I was going through some of the stuff that you had done with Dave Tate and you talked about it, I was like, oh, shit, like you're the first person I've actually spoken to that had it done.
Yeah. Also talk to Juju Mufu. He had his knees done down there. He was down there at the same time I was. I didn't know that, but we're pretty good friends, but I didn't know he was in Cabo at the same time. But you get mixed results. I mean, some people are going to get better from it. Some people aren't. So I can't say it's good or bad, but I haven't seen it really fix an organ problem yet from what I've seen. I've seen it mitigate the damage or at least slow it down, but I haven't seen it fully repair anything.
Yeah, I think I saw on Adil's social media that Chris Bumsfeld.
Bumstead, he's got kidney issues too.
Yeah, and that he had done a series of injections on him as well. So I just didn't know if, I assume the guy was still competing. So, or at least I saw him compete. So I would assume
I don't know Adil would know more, but his kidney function was worse than mine. Mm. By a shitload, which makes me believe that possibly diuretics might be more harmful than anabolics for kidney function.
Yeah, this tails back to something Louis told me once when we were talking about performance enhancers, and he made a good point where he said, you're going to see all the bodybuilders die before the power lifters. Mm-hmm. And he always felt that it had to do with the dehydration and the weight cuts and like the low body fat and a lot of the, you know, crazy dieting. And he said, those guys end up dying all the time. But he goes, and powerlifters, by community, probably take more drugs than the bodybuilders, which I can't really imagine.
I would say being around the sport for a long time and having a lot of friends on both ends of drug free and drug tested, I can tell you right now, bodybuilders take way fucking more. I mean, it's not even funny. I mean, I remember there was a guy that was here in town named Mike Francois. You remember that dude?
Yeah.
He was the best bodybuilder ever from Ohio. No, hands down, just jacked. And I remember him sitting down with somebody else at Westside Barbell. It wasn't Louie. It was George or it was Kenny Patterson or somebody. And he said that he basically had a toolbox full of drugs that he had to take a month. And you're just like, what the fuck? I mean, like the amount of GH, insulin. See, a lot of that stuff's not really going to help you be a power lifter. It's not going to help you be stronger per se. I mean, it might help you gain a little bit of muscle mass, but some of that muscle mass is not going to be necessarily utilized. Where you find in powerlifting, muscle mass has a component, but the neurological system is actually more of a driver for increasing maximal strength than actual muscle mass. So I think there's a certain point where pro bodybuilders get to a certain point that the normal anabolics that would make you stronger, like your D-ball, your testosterone, all those are just not going to inquire more hypertrophy. Versus now you got to go to other extreme drugs like GH, insulin to shuttle that shit in even harder. And, you know, again, look at Liver King. How much was he spending on growth hormone a month? It was something like $10,000 a month. That like nobody is right now. Everybody at Westside Barbell was broke as fuck. Nobody was affording that. You know what I mean? Yeah, so get that right out of there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the Liver King dude looks. I mean, that guy's fucking shredded. Don't get me wrong, but like everything about his whole deal, like whatever that is, I would fucking do a U-turn on that.
Oh, I know. But you know that this thing though is like we as a society have one shock factor. How does that guy make like what $50 million off of everybody else's stupidity? I mean, well, you and I could look at him and said, I know exactly what he's doing.
Yeah. And the whole thing seemed insane to me. Like I like at first for a long time, I thought he was trolling people. And then I found out that he had a supplement and people were buying it. And I was like, you would buy supplements from this fucking crazy person?
I mean, like, dude, I know it's fucking crazy.
And I mean, the guy crushed it. And then all of a sudden he comes out and they're like, oh, he's taking drugs. And you know, he's like, people were shocked. I'm like, Are you fucking insane? Like this dude's crazy looking.
Dude, I watched that series because I just had to see it. And like, it fascinates me how fucking stupid people are.
No, it's, well, I think we've come into like a time of consumers where people just want to be entertained. It's the circus, it's the Roman circus, right? You know, they want to see the blood. They want to see the entertainment. They want to see the car wreck. I look at it and I think it just devalues everything.
It does.
Yeah. True. I mean, it devalues health. It devalues wellness. I mean, the entire shtick.
Nobody's looking at that through a 16-year-old kid's eyelids.
Yeah.
Right? Like, nobody's looking at that through their mindset and their scope. Now they have no idea who to believe in. Everybody's a fraud. Everything is about, you know, grabbing your attention and selling you bullshit. And so everybody feels like everybody's trying to one-up everybody versus, like, the actual coaches that are actually trying to make people better, like you and me and, you know, a lot of other guys, it gets clouded because somebody else has $1 million to throw out at marketing, you know, and just push their agenda out on people. That's total bullshit.
Yeah. And now you don't even need $1 million. All you need is just ChatGPT and AI and being able to take, I mean, to the point where I did watch one video where the people were stealing the transcripts, having it put into new stuff, reading it back. I mean, I think just like everything, right? Like in 2020, we saw, you know, there was, you know, BLM and woke, and now you're seeing all this stuff kind of swing back in the pendulum. I think this stuff will swing back the same way. It has to, because it's unsustainable. Yeah. Like, how do you know what to believe? And I think when people don't believe anything, they just turn off. And if the most of what we see on the internet and social media, I mean, like I was doing a Google search and the first thing that comes up is this like AI bot that tells me the information. And I'm like looking at this and I'm thinking of all of the people that are spending a fortune to try to, you know, optimize for Google. And now all of that is dead because AI popped up. And I don't need to read the AI aggregate. I want to actually click through the links and read the information. But I also remember we come from a different time and there's a whole different perception. Now people are just like, give me the quick version. I don't even care if it's right or not. Just give it to me fast.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's all about quick now, you know, 10 seconds of attention. You know, it's really destroying a lot of our culture, not even just in the fitness industry and everything.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, yeah. One of the things you brought up with the winning warm-ups and your interpretation of GPP and, you know, obviously with Verkhoshansky and, you know, Zadiskorsky and their emphasis on creating general physical preparedness and just the fact that you're creating this baseline capacity. How did that piece really like help drive you. And not only, I mean, I got to think that, you know, as you're talking about, you know, training and being able to handle these percentages for 20 plus years, that level of conditioning and just being able to be, you know, aerobically fit to be able to survive and recover felt like it probably the missing piece.
Well, it kind of fell again, pushing my own limits. It found its way back. So I was reading one of the manuals, and it had this talk where Alexiev would take a 50-pound kettlebell before he touched any Olympic lifting, and he would do all these different swings for 15 minutes straight. And I was like, well, that's interesting. He's warming up a non-specific way for 15 minutes before he touches a barbell. So that was kind of a light bulb, but not the all light bulb. Then I go to 2012, I go speak for the Sydney SWAT team in Australia, and there was a lady there that was in the symposium that was talking about post-activation potentiation that she was doing as her PhD with some pro rugby players, and how they were doing these lighter exercises before the main movement, and they were actually seeing decent results. I'm like, fuck, I don't do anything like that. Well, fast forward 2013, the end of 2012, I go and I bench my first 600 raw. And it's literally five blocks from Louis' gym. And so that starts the process of me looking at the raw world records and going, I think I can take these, because I had done raw like every third week anyway. So I knew I was pretty close on the squat for sure. So I go to this meet, and it's right on the Indiana-Ohio line. And I hit the third highest total of all time, but I had missed I only got like 7 for 9. I missed two crucial lifts. And I'm driving home and I'm thinking, you know, my first meathead thought is, you know, I just need to get stronger, right? You know, powerlifter, you need to get stronger. And then for some reason, that post-activation potentiation talk clicked into my head. I started digging and digging. And I started looking at doing pre-fatiguing exercises. So my bench was 600, but at that meet, it was only 572 because I had squatted 800 pounds. So I was trashed. I was tired. And I was like, well, maybe if I train my bench tired, then I'll be used to it and it'll bounce back. And so I start off really light and I give myself a 15-minute window. And then I'm like, which two muscle groups are probably the ones that are limiting factors? My lats staying tight and my triceps. So I do tricep pushdowns and lats and then dumbbell presses. And I'm talking like 30-pound dumbbells as a 600-pound bencher. Nothing heavy, just very methodical, very perfect technique. Fast forward about 6 months later, I do my first raw unity contest. I squat the world record and I break the all-time world record total. My bench was back to 606 after a world record squat. I'm like, holy shit. So I plugged it in with the bench press. Well, the next meet, plugged it in with the squat. Squat jumps up another, take the world record from 832 to 865.5. So now I'm like, okay, it's working. And then I bench 611. I'm like, this is working. So what I found was that was my limiting factor. Well, during that time, in those couple of years, I started implementing that winning warm-up with the tactical divisions over at my fire departments. And then I started noticing their body fat was going down, their lean mass number was going up, and the injuries were reducing, which I have scales for this from the insurance company to see it, over like 150 guys. And I'm like, well, shit, this is working for stuff that I didn't even imagine. And so that's how it kind of started, and I just started plugging it away with different people in different scenarios, and it seemed to work for nearly everything. And a lot of it was just building you're taking muscle groups in the beginning and you're utilizing a way to isolate muscle groups that you know are probably not going to turn on to where they should be on the maximal lift. And it's making their technique better, i.e. making it safer, i.e. giving them a better motor pattern for the movement. And so, you know, that's how it started. And then I just started speaking on it and digging more and doing more experiments with different populations. And that's how it started.
Well, I mean, I've noticed this exact same thing, right? When I start pushing, and I do a lot of conditioning on like the echo bikes and the air bikes, just because there's no eccentric load. So I can really kind of push a lot. I found when, you know, obviously doing a lot of that for me, like that base level of conditioning is like so important for not only the autonomic stuff, like all my sleeping numbers, but also all my strength numbers. So, I mean, it's been a godsend. Yeah. But I got a lot of that non-specific warm-up stuff through the Charlie Francis.
And I saw Charlie Francis speak at Swiss, and he was talking about a lot of that shit and warming up the motor unit, like actually increasing temperature by 1 or 2 degrees Celsius in the muscle tissue the excitation process from the central nervous system. I didn't see any downsides other than the people that complain because they don't know what weight to use. They're sloppy with their form, and then they're too out of shape to do a maximum effort lift after the warm-up, which, again, should show you where your weaknesses are anyway. Yeah. I just found it at the top. So trying to help people like that, you know.
I feel like, and this is, you know, some of the podcasts we did in the past, like we interviewed Laura Phelps, and I was going back and looking at a bunch of clips. And the one thing which is kind of fascinating is like the death of geared lifting and the rise, obviously, of, you know, raw lifting. And I actually go back to like, what was his name? Dan Green, I think, was like the first guy that I saw that really crushed the raw lifting. And I kind of started and lit the fire a little bit.
I'd say probably Eric Lillibridge and Stan Efferding.
Yeah. You think those guys were kind of the...
Maybe even first.
Well, what's crazy is Stan, even though he was raw, looked like he was squatting in about 13 layers of gear. You know, see, now he sat back into everything. But, I mean, those guys really kind of sparked this bit of a revolution. And now it seems like anytime I see anything powerlifting-based, it's usually raw lifting more so than any of the geared lifting.
Mm-hmm.
And
you want to know why you think that is?
Yeah. Is it just
I think as people can relate to the numbers, you know, somebody benches 600 raw, the average person can kind of wrap their head around that. You see somebody doing 1300 in a shirt, nobody understands that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not impressive, but it's not real. And I think the beginning of, I think what really hurt the geared lifting, and again, from the people that we've talked about beforehand, is that it started to get really lax in judging about 2011, 2012, 2013, about the time I exited and went into raw lifting. You started seeing squats getting past 2 inches above parallel. You started seeing weak handoffs and guys holding the bar all the way down to where they touched. You started seeing not locked out deadlifts, and it started really tainting the equipped lifting, you know? And so I think that was a portion of it too. Whereas in the raw lifting, it was a lot harder. The judging was always stricter in some ways, shapes, and forms, right? Like the squats, you don't have a suit to stop you an inch above parallel. Like, you're going to get crushed. If you put 800 pounds on your back, you're probably going to squat down to depth because it's going to force you. So I think that the relative mindset to the average person watching is a little bit more understandable than the equipped, where somebody can see somebody bench pressing more than anybody's ever squatted before. I don't think that makes any sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I watched a video, and I think it was, is it Jimmy Cobb?
Yeah.
Jimmy Cobb. I think he did something crazy. It was like 1,100 for like 13 reps. You know, and it was so astronomical, because I remember when like a 1,000-pound bench, even in a shirt, was a big deal. And I remember when we went out to Westside. Yeah, I remember when I went out there, we did some max effort floor press, and I think I floor pressed like 495, and I think AJ floor pressed 500, let's say. And he threw his shirt on a couple days later and benched like 945 or something.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, holy shit, dude. Like, it is almost 500 pounds of carryover is what you get out of that shirt. And then...
Yeah, the first time I saw that and realized the writing was on the wall, and I was already working my way out of the gear, I went down to Cincinnati to help at Laura Phelps's meet, and the guy was the 242 all-time world record holder. We're back in the warm-up room. He almost gets crushed with 405 raw. He puts a shirt on, benches 935 in the meet. And you're like, what? Whereas, like, George Halbert would bench press 635 raw, put on a shirt, and bench 750. And you're like, okay, that makes sense. You know, I think the gear just got so advanced so quick that it just, the numbers just didn't make any sense anymore. And people were just like, this is all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
And I think that's what hurt Louis, and where Louis felt like Westside was way on top and then fell down. Louis never followed the raw scheme. I saw it coming. And so I just said, fuck it. I'm taking it all off. I'm going raw. And I did for the last 5 years. I competed. And I think it saved me a lot, because you get a lot of guys that I trained with that stayed in equipment, or maybe a little after me. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't matter. And like, why are you going to put yourself in that position to have an asterisk next to your name? You know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah. No, I was even clicking around, and, you know, Dave Hoff's still out there doing, you know, geared lifting and I think now he's like, what's he, Mr. 3010 or 3012, 2015. And, you know, he hits a big squat and, you know, goes crazy. And like, the problem is I had to search on the internet. I don't see that stuff anywhere.
Nope.
But then, who was it? The English kid, that was like, what, like the, 110 kilo, like squatted what, like 1,000 pounds and deadlifted.
Oh, you're talking about Colton Elderbright, the guy from South Africa.
Yeah.
He's everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I see
he's
it. I mean, shit, he's 22 years old or 23 years old and, you know, deadlifted 1,000 pounds.
He's the new wave Ed Cohen. I honestly, those numbers that he's doing right now are unfathomable to me. I can't understand how somebody that young with so little of training, he has amazing technique, but I don't know. Like I look at it and I can't fathom it because numbers like that 15 years ago, you didn't even see in gear. You know, and now you're seeing this kid do it raw and you're like, what is going on? It's like, I'm sure it's the same feeling that Ed Cohen gave everybody back in the 80s when he was doing those crazy numbers at 165, 181. And you're just like, this guy's not even human. It's the same thing we're seeing right now. I just hope that he has longevity in his mindset to be able to sustain that for any length of time, because to me, it looks like a bottle rocket. You're going to see the boom, you know, they're gone because they just train like a fucking idiots. You know what I mean?
Well, I almost think if I was that kid, they should have sandbagged him for a bunch of years, you know, kind of like, hey, you're going to go in and, you know, set the world record by 10 pounds and 10 pounds and 10 pounds and give me some more.
Exactly what Alexiev did.
Yeah.
Break the world record 70 times by 1 kilo.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what the Russians do and the Bulgarians. I mean, that's what those guys did. Like they get paid for world records. So why smash it by 30?
It's all about breaking a record. You know, if they break a record, they get more money. So yeah, I don't know. To me, I would do it a little bit different, but you know, everybody's got their own path. What do you do?
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully, he does have good longevity. This entire time, I've been sitting back looking at like a shelves of books and supplements and trophies. And I know you mentioned you have a master's. Like, do you stress that formal education to people outside the lifting circles or even in the lifting circles or people that reach out to you that are young and upcoming and want to kind of get into it? And like, you know, because there is
I have an intern here at the house right now from Melbourne, Australia, that's come to learn all of this stuff that I have behind me. I do. And, you know, that's what pushed me to write the book. And then so I have an honorary doctorate from a university overseas, which is that little thing in the back right there. Everything's been recycled. So all the new shit is old. You just have to know where to look for it. And so for me, I don't know that I can learn a lot more with volume, intensity, duration, but muscle fiber technology, learning how the central nervous system reacts to agonist and antagonist muscle groups, how passive tissue plays a role in muscle contraction. Those are all still what I call gray areas where you start reading a book, you're like, man, I never thought that was the case. And for me, it's just, I like the cat and mouse game. I like being able to go and read something, learn it, apply it, or have it reinforce what I've already done. And so I think that without doing that and just going into the gym, you can sell yourself short on not only how strong you can be, but how much more you can help other people or identify problems before they become major issues.
So you obviously you brought up the book a few times. I mean, what's the scope of the book? And you said that they were dragging your feet on getting it published, but
I gave them the entire manuscript in May of 2023 and we're still getting editing back. And so I get a chapter back and I get like 5 words changed in a chapter. And I'm like, what have you guys been doing for the last 3 months? So I don't know what's going on with Human Kinetics with it, but they've had it. It's got almost 1200 references. It's all that stuff in the back. It's a lot of books I got from Louis and Charles Poliquin and guys of that nature and Fred Hatfield. It's one of those things that, you know, I wanted to give all the information that I had learned over the last 30 something years of training so that somebody else can find it a way faster. Because you know how Louis talked, the Russians talked about this and talked about that. Where did they talk about it?
I think you made up a lot of shit.
Right. There's no references. Yeah. So I tried to do the academic work that Louis just didn't do. And I understand why he didn't do it. He didn't care. He wanted the numbers.
Sure.
But my point being is like, where do you go and look that stuff up in one solid book that has all of that already degenerated down to where the average American can read it and get something out of it, right? So we're trying to get it done. I'm hoping it's done by the end of this year, but you know, just crossing my fingers.
No,
I've done all the work. What do you do? But
yeah, now you just got to wait for those guys to get it pushed out. Last thing I want to wrap a little bit about cars.
Yeah.
I know you're a big car guy. Yeah. So what are you working on?
Well, I have a 70 Charger. So a Dukes of Hazzard car with a Hellcat drivetrain swap. Then I have a 72 Impala that has a 2022 Camaro SS engine drivetrain with a supercharger on it. And then I have a 92 Dodge extended cab, long bed, four-wheel drive truck. It's pushing 1,000 horsepower on diesel turbos with two 250 shots of nitrous, and it's fully rally, like trophy truck ready.
Is that done?
It's just about done.
It's just about done?
Yeah, it's all painted. My dad died in 93. I went and looked at that truck with my dad. He wanted one, didn't get it, ended up becoming terminal. So I found it, and then I painted it his favorite drink color, which was A&W root beer. So I used all the colors of A&W root beer in the paint. I've been working on that for about 10 years. It's close to done. And then I have a handful of motorcycles that I've rode to Stone Cold Steve Austin's house. And I got an old school Indian that I really like, and an old school shovel head that's in the late 60s. So I just like tinkering with a lot of different shit. But it just takes time. You know, like I like to go out and wrench on stuff and experiment. Most of the work on the Charger I did myself, because when do you get a chance to Hellcat swap probably one of the baddest muscle cars ever made? And the answer is not very many times. So that took me about 3.5 years to put together.
Yeah, no, the Hellcat engines and transmissions pop up all the time down here in Texas. So it's like the most stolen car. So I'm pretty sure these guys are stealing them. I see them pop up on Facebook Marketplace all the time. And I'm always like, The problem is they're usually about a 3-hour drive. And every time I hit the guy up, it's like, you got to be on the way over there with cash. But at some point I'll find one. I want to swap one in. The back end standalone support is so much better now for the Hellcats than they were.
What car are you going to put it in?
49 Mercury.
Okay.
Yeah. So I got a 49 Merc on an Art Morrison chassis that I got sitting in the shop.
You might want to think about, instead of, you can keep it kind of Ford, is go with a Super Snake motor.
Yeah. Or so even those 7.3.
I have two four performance motor with a supercharger, because that would probably fit a Mercury a little better. And I'll tell you this, the Hellcat wire, Mopar makes the wiring on those a pain in the ass. If you go a Ford swap or a Chevy swap, you'll be a lot easier on the actual running of the ECU and the wiring, for sure.
Yeah.
But you would never, if you pulled up in a Merc with a GT500 swap motor, that would be bitching.
I've seen some guys running those 7.3 Godzilla motors.
Yeah.
with superchargers.
I've heard good and bad. Well, I had a guy that when I was building my truck, he put a supercharger on one of those Godzilla motors, and he blew it up within 15,000 miles. Now, he was an idiot, but my point being is, like, I've seen those Hellcat engines and those Shelby motors take an ass whooping and never blow up. So I'm not so sure.
And the transmissions are bulletproof.
Mechanics.
What's that? No. I said, and the transmissions are bulletproof.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen a lot of those 7.3 Godzilla motors in the truck shop with the mechanics that I train. They have a lot of servicing issues. Yeah. I don't know what's wrong with them exactly, but I think it's either the cam swipes out on the lifters, or they have main bearing issues or something up with them.
Yeah. No, I've messed with, I put Cummins diesels in just about everything. I got a Duramax swap we've been doing, but I kind of, there was years ago, I saw a bitch in 49 Mercury that this guy ended up having like a pretty bitch in like 60s Hemi in it. And so I obviously kind of saw that and was like, you know what? And then when I saw, like, same thing happened when I went to go originally look at some of the Hellcat swaps, the wiring was kind of janky, you know, like you said, it was all coming from Mopar, but I feel like within like the last probably 3-6 months, they've actually kind of stepped it up. And now there's some really like decent on offline, like, you know, standalone support for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually having to get mine tuned again. At the 1st of July, there's a place called On3 that they do a lot of big tuning on some big motors here. And he knows which codes are. I did an actual swap from a salvaged car, and when I did that, I used the stock ECU, so it throws security codes and it tells the transmission when the wheels slip that it's not picking up the wheel speed sensors and stuff like that. So I'll send you some pictures of it when we get done off here, and I'll show it to you. But I did a lot of handiwork on that, and when I did it, it was one of the first swaps in the Midwest. I put that engine in that car in 2020.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's
so cool. And again, I'm still playing with it, getting it to run perfect. It'll, you can drive it all day now. I can drive it to your house, but if I want to really stomp on it, I got to get it. I got to get it all fixed up because it just gets confused.
Is there any dream car, any Eleanor, anything out there that like you kind of always
see? The 70RT Charger was really my dream car. You know, it was one of those ones that I had to find the body in New Mexico. I had to bring it in. We had to redo it all. It was all the original panels. The only other car that I had that I wish I still had is I had an 87 Grand National. Mm. And it was not, it was done tastefully.
Nice.
And I would like to get another one of those back again. I just think they're just iconic, probably the coolest 80s car.
Yeah.
Especially if they're done right. But, honestly, I've just burned my, I've burned every length of what kind of car I've ever wanted. I just sold my 62 Impala Super Sport and an LS2 in it with twin turbos. And that was my dream car when I was in high school. Cause I grew up in the Dr. Dre Eazy-E era. And that car was like king shit, 62, 3 or 4 Impala. I liked the 62 the best. And I restored it and did it all up. And, I just ended up getting rid of it. Cause I'm just working on paying off my house now, but the other ones I still have.
Nice. Well, shit, man. I'd love to see some, pictures. Well, dude, hey man, that was awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time. Hopefully all this stuff kind of abates and you're able to kind of get out on the other side of it, but it seems like you're managing it more. I mean, pretty much anybody else would have fucking died by now, but it's, right.
I know. I mean, still here for now.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like if you didn't have the education and, really that like attention to detail, I don't know if you would have caught it. And I mean, the part, like I said earlier, that resonated was the fact that you were like microdosing rhabdo for 20 years. And that was something, you know, I worried about. So when I get my blood work, I'm always very, very conscious of like liver and kidney function, which I've been very lucky, like just being pretty durable in that way. But
The only thing that's really out of whack now is my ferritin level is weird, but my iron level is perfect. It's super weird. Like I have inflammation there, but it's getting better every time I get my blood work done.
Wow. So. Well, hopefully it looks better 5 to 10 years from now than it did. And I'm excited to read the book, dude. So thanks for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time.
All right, brother.
Yep.
Take it easy.
See ya. Be good.
Later.
See ya. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales we've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.